Welcome back to the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. We are in the midst of a mailbag here with Seth Partnow. We're taking this to a part two with Danny on vacation. We're brought to you today by Indochino, who makes awesome made-to-order suits. We'll tell you more about them later in the show. Seth, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
I think we're recording this, maybe 45 seconds after we concluded the last episode?
It's the magic of radio. It's the next day. Recording into the future.
All right, let's get right into it here. This question is from Austin Peters. For Seth, who would win one-on-one, you or Nate?
Nate's a big boy. I don't know, honestly, I think it to some extent would depend on the rules. A lot of times you play one-on-one kind of maximum, five dribbles or something like that. I don't think I would ever stop Nate if he was just allowed to dribble and back me down forever. That's how I'll dodge that question. What do you think, Nate?
Yeah, I think that would probably matter. Although, I mean, we could agree that we could have a Mark Jackson 5 second back down rule or something like that. That might make it a little bit better. What I actually like to do sometimes when I'm trying to get in shape is just play one-on-one with a 5 second shot clock. That is exhausting. Yeah. That is a really fun way to get in shape instead of just running on a treadmill or something. And, usually you play to because I've never had the greatest cardio, but you play to three or four and you're just totally exhausted because you're going hard for essentially just, as long as it takes to finish the game, and doing anything for a minute or two as hard as you can is going to be exhausting. Especially when Ethan and I will play that way, and it's really tiring for him because he'll get the rebound and then just sprint back to the 3-point line and then just shoot a three, because that's his best advantage. I'm guessing that'd probably be your strategy against me too.
Yeah. I'd also try to pull an Ethan and sprain your ankle. Or did you sprain his ankle? How did that?
I sprained his ankle. Yeah. He went up for a layup and landed on my ankle, and landed on my foot, spraining his ankle. But yeah, sorry, that was diplomatic enough. I'm sure we both think we'd beat each other, but this is quite magnanimous on both of our parts. All right, this is a good one for you. This is from Ikedar Hanif. What makes Popovich the best coach in the NBA? I guess we'll find out whether Seth agrees with that or not. How does he distinguish himself from the likes of Rick Carlisle, who is arguably the second best coach in the NBA?
I love this question. First of all, I do think Pop is the best coach in the NBA, just because if you look at the different styles in which he has flourished and managed to kind of rebuild and remake a team and have a team that plays according to the personnel on the team, which he obviously has a role in picking, but not just, this is my system, we do it this way just because. The other point is, I think that we tend to talk about coaches in such a kind of a binary fashion. This guy is good at coaching or bad at coaching. We would never, I mean, we do, but we'd very rarely talk about players. This guy's good or bad. This guy's a good shooter. He's a good ball handler, defense, passer, all those things. I think just as much as there's a range of skills that make a player good or not, there's a range of skills that make a coach good or not, and it's everything. It's the X's and O's. We talked last time about kind of that kind of the rah-rah stuff that we tend to see in huddles, and whether that in-game stuff matters that much. I think over 82 games, having a team that plays that's motivated every night, that's far from a given, and that's a real skill that some coaches have better than others. And I think a lot of the coaches that get kind of some of the least respect kind of on the internet are coaches who are good at that. I guess the classic example is Scott Brooks, who is, I think, still nobody's idea of an X's and O's tactician. But, you look at those Oklahoma City teams, they played hard and played together all the time under him. And that's far from nothing, especially kind of compared to some of the up and downs they've had this year. So anyway, your thoughts on this, Nate?
Yeah, I do think Pop is the best, and he is the best in really pretty much every aspect that you can think of, except for maybe one. One is, and this doesn't get talked about all that much, player development. The Spurs have developed their players wonderfully under him, whether it's George Hill, who they traded away, Tony Parker, Manu Ginobili, You know, I mean, you look, obviously a lot of that is good scouting to get those guys on the team to begin with. Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard is probably the most salient example. Patty Mills. Even someone like Matt Bonner, right? Like, you know, who was kind of nothing and came to play a pretty decent role on some of those good teams. And that really is, David Locke and I were just talking about this on a previous episode, that really, as a coach, if you can develop guys and put them in positions to succeed when they're young and develop them into a role, which is something I think that they do incredibly well, that can be more value added than anything that you're doing strategically, perhaps. And I think that is, to me, is what separates Pop from Carlisle, is that Carlisle has not really shown the ability to do that. You know, he likes playing veterans. You know, someone like Justin Anderson, for example, has like played little this year. I mean, really the only Mavericks draft pick I can think of who has developed on Carlisle's watch. Roddy Beauvoir was ruined by injuries, but Carlisle rarely played him. And then Jay Crowder, who they, of course, traded away, are the only ones that I could really look at. So that to me is the biggest thing that differentiates them. I actually would say that I might like Carlisle a little bit better as sort of a playoff adjustment style tactician. And I think that Pop has done some weird things, like the fouling against the Clippers and then like taking Kawhi Leonard out for 8 minutes of the third quarter in game seven because he gave up a backdoor. Like that kind of stuff, I thought, you know, is a little weird. But that overall, I think that Pop just puts all of it together. You know, his approach to the 82 game season, I mean, just getting his guys to play hard, like he really doesn't have a weakness. And I think everyone else at least has somewhat of one.
Yeah, and although I think you might be being slightly harsh on Carlisle, maybe he's not as developing the young guys, but in terms of...
Yeah, I'm not even saying he's done a bad job. It's just that we don't know that he's done the awesome job that Pop is. I mean, I think you have to say he's below Pop in that category, whether you want to say he's average or good or bad.
In terms of fitting guys into roles in which they can succeed, the smoke and mirrors that Dallas has kind of gone through over the last, basically since they won the title and have been competitive the whole time, I think is a testament to kind of what he can do in terms of recognizing, all right, this is what we have, this is how that can win. And that's, you know, that kind of honest self-assessment of his own team is incredibly valuable, I think.
He's definitely awesome. Is Steve Kerr in this conversation for you?
Not yet, and here's why. And this is kind of sort of my basic conservatism about anointing people early, but a few things. First of all, a lot of the shine on Steve Kerr is by comparison, you know what I mean? This is something that gets talked about all the time, but you compare the way that Golden State played in 2013-14 to the way they played last year and then this year, and it's night and day, but it didn't exactly take a genius to see that, you know, ball and player movement was a good fit for the talent on the Warriors, that basically everyone except the coach at the time could see that it was a better fit for the talent. So, you know, that was a competent decision to go to that. You know, the implementation has certainly seemed like it's been great. How much of that is Kerr? How much of that is Curry? How much of that is Kerr empowering Curry and empowering Klay Thompson? Those are hard to untangle. But we just haven't seen really Kerr in other situations enough to know, you know, okay, in this situation, he's been great. But I think the thing that separates, you know, a Pop or a Carlisle or, you know, any of the other coaches you might want to put ahead of Kerr is the fact that they've handled multiple situations with a great deal of aplomb. And, you know, I think it's well established that, you know, certain coaches are better with certain type of team. And this being only, you know, Kerr's basically coached a year and a bit in the NBA. So we don't know how he would handle other kinds of teams really at all, you know?
Yeah, no, we don't. And that's one of that we only have a year and a half sample size. I mean, I'm still going to give a lot of the credit to the early part of the year for Kerr, and their defense has obviously been awesome. He's gotten Steph to defend much better than he used to. I mean, I think that challenging him in that aspect has really helped. You know, the taking the shackles off of someone like Draymond Green as well, that I think we have seen under him great individual improvement from a ton of guys. I think that you can throw that in. It basically, other than just a very few things on the margins, which basically boils down to playing some of their crappier players to keep them engaged and you know, keep guys fresh and resting them. Other than that, I can't really think of much that Kerr has done that I have disagreed with or that I can see much room for improvement on. I mean, is there anything in his performance so far that you think hasn't been good?
You know, I think some of the rotation decisions are, you know, occasionally, but, you know, that's a lot of that is preference and you know, you're, like you said, keeping guys fresh, keeping guys engaged, those kinds
of things. In the playoffs, I didn't really have much of a problem with what he did, though, you know? So that makes me think that it's more just kind of a regular season.
Well, but
thing.
You've been someone who goes on, who has talked a lot about, you know, well, why not just start that way instead of, you know, having to make the adjustment to whether it's, you know, being Iguodala.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah, but it, you know, I mean, they've also, like, I mean, Andre can't play that many minutes during the regular season, and Barnes, at least last year, before he got injured this year, was playing at a really high level and played much better than he did under Jackson. So I appreciate the whole, and then also just the idea of now that Andre has sacrificed, nobody else can bitch either. You know, that I think has been pretty important as well in setting the culture. So I think maybe in certain playoff series, you might be better off starting Andre if you have to guard LeBron James and he's killing Barnes. Yeah, I could see that. But overall, I think during the regular season, I'm okay with that, especially because Andre's a guy who can kind of get injured and wear down.
I don't have anything bad to say about you know, the job Kerr has done. It's just, it's on the other hand, you know, this is, you know, I don't want to say it's an easy gig, but in terms of the problems he has are good problems to have as a coach, you know what I mean? And so, you know, they haven't really been beset by a rash of injuries since he's been there. They haven't had these, you know, some of that is testament to him that they haven't been in situations where they've been on losing streaks and stuff like that. But, you know, there's just all these scenarios that, you know, over enough time coaches deal with, he hasn't dealt with yet. And, you know, there's great reason to think that he will handle them all well. We just haven't seen it yet. And that's kind of, I'm not skeptical. He just hasn't proven it yet. You know what I mean? Is that fair?
Yeah. No, I feel you. I think that he belongs in the conversation, just doesn't have quite as much of a track record. Very quickly, is there anyone else who you think should be in this conversation for the NBA's best coach?
Best coach? No. I mean, I've consistently said it's Pop and Carlisle, the top two. Other guys who should be in kind of that upper area. I mean, you talk about Terry Stotts. You talk about you know, Brad Stevens, who I honestly think a lot of the same issues that I have with Kerr apply to Stevens also. I mean, he's done really well with kind of a young up-and-coming team. How he deals with it if they, you know, add superstar talent and are a contender now, that remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen him go through a playoff series and adjust. And in fact, I was pretty critical of the way how little he used Jay Crowder guarding LeBron James in last year's playoffs, for example. Not that they're going to win that series if he had done it differently, but I think he's been a very good coach in the regular season. Coach Bud is another one that you could maybe look at in Atlanta as well.
Spoelstra is, you know, he does some things you don't like, but in general, like, you know, getting back.
Yeah, the results are good.
And getting back to a team that, like, it competes no matter what else they have. In general, you like Stan Van Gundy, although he's a guy who sometimes Stan, the GM, hasn't helped the coach as well as he might have. So those are, I mean, for me, that's kind of the short list. I think, you know, this year you kind of have to look at what Memphis has done and that doesn't look bad for Dave Yeager, but you know, he's had ups and downs before. So it's there's just so much going on that we don't see that it's really hard to, you know, aside from the clear outlier guys, it's hard to really pick out who's doing a better or worse job.
Let's take a quick break to talk to you about a new sponsor we have, Indochino Custom Menswear. For those who are not regular listeners of the pod, I'm 6'6". I weigh about 235 pounds, and finding an off-the-rack suit is nearly impossible. You go in there, I have big shoulders but a narrow chest and stomach, so to get something that's big enough to fit my shoulders, it's just enormous in the chest and stomach. You can alter it, but it's never going to be quite right. And then when you have a big suit up top, then the pants are always like 40 inches wide, and that's never going to fit you either. It's so much easier to just get your suit made to measure. And that's what Indochino does affordably, really, for the first time. You get a one-of-a-kind made-to-measure suit. You can customize the details you want. You pick your lining, your lapels. If you want a monogram, you can do that. There are 14 unique measurements that go into making the suit that fits you perfectly. And they also make made-to-measure dress shirts and men's accessories. If it doesn't fit you right, they will alter it for you. And if it still doesn't fit you right, then you can get your money back. So there's no risk in doing it. And today, my listeners can get any premium suit for just $3.99, up to 50% off at Indochino.com when entering code CAPSPACE, that familiar CAPSPACE code, at checkout. Shipping is free. There's no reason not to try this. If it doesn't work for you, you can get it altered, return it, go to Indochino.com, promo code CAPSPACE for any premium suit, just $3.99, free shipping, Indochino.com, promo code CAPSPACE. Indochino, your look, your way. All right, what do we have next here?
Georgia Monroe Cook asks, do you think Atlanta has made the mistake of signing players to short contracts and not having Bird right? People thought the first Paul Millsap contract was great, but it kind of backfired last offseason.
Yeah, and one of the other ones where that's been an issue is Damari Carroll. They signed him to basically a two-year, $5 million deal and then weren't able to exceed the cap as much to re-sign him. I don't think so, though, because you have to remember the ages that those guys were at. And Kent Bazemore, they've got that same problem again with him this year. You have to remember the ages and pedigrees of these guys when they were signed, right? Like Millsap was, I think, 27 when he signed, and he's a short power forward. So you think, all right, 27 and 28, we're going to get this guy. We're not going to have to overpay on the back end. You know, there was no way to know that Damari Carroll in 2 years was going to turn into a guy who was going to merit a $15 million a year contract. Paul Millsap, there was no way to know that he was going to turn into an all-star maybe even a top 20 player in the league when they signed him. So I think the process at the time was right. They maintained flexibility, and you think, all right, we can always re-sign these guys, too, if we need to. And you don't know, too, that like not only are we not going to be able to re-sign these guys, but then that their required contract is going to be so much above what they had last time that they won't even fit within the early Bird exception. I think you definitely did the right thing in signing those guys to 2 years. Carroll, I think, was 27 when he signed too. You get him for those prime years. You don't lock into the bad contract at the end. That was the right thing to do at the time, and they're just simply victims of their own unanticipated success, and they shouldn't be blamed for that.
Yeah, I think that the Millsap, the first Millsap contract was surprising in a vacuum. It seemed like, and I know we've disagreed about Paul Millsap before, thinking back to like the pod we did before the 2014 World Championships.
I still think he's really good, by the way.
I've been a Millsap guy for a long time. And so that was like, these kind of questions can kind of look past the, like, all right, maybe you have a hard time re-signing him, but you've got Paul Millsap for 2 years, even if you couldn't re-sign him. So the value of that is something that kind of tends to get overlooked, as people are always saying, well, what about the future? Well, what about what he did while he was here? And you obviously got great value for money on that. On the other hand, it's a reasonable type of question, just because, you know, you look at, for example, Sacramento with Rondo. This is something I think we've talked about before.
Yeah. One year and 2 years is a big difference. 1 year, unless it's like a prove it contract, 1 year is too short. 2 years, in most circumstances, that early Bird's is going to be enough. And really, the only reason it wasn't was that the cap just unanticipatedly has gone up so much these last 2 years, and will again in 2017. And then once we get beyond 2017, we'll start to have more normal increases again, and those contracts will be just fine again, even to the limited extent that they weren't before.
Yeah, so it's you know, a victim of both of those, that circumstance, and also, as you said, I mean, they're just vastly outperforming their contract in a way that, you know, if, you know, sign me up for that every time, basically. If I can get this guy who triples the value of his contract, but I have to worry about losing him 2 years. Okay, that's not a hard that's not a hard bargain to strike for me.
Will Derrick Rose, this is from Aaron Sampson, will Derrick Rose be the only MVP to not make the Hall of Fame?
So far.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know 200 years in the future whether he will be, but yeah, I mean, when he retires, I mean, basically what you're asking is, will Derrick Rose make the Hall of Fame? Because every other MVP, I believe, is in the Hall of Fame, or even anyone who has already won MVP, probably even if they retired tomorrow, would be in the Hall of Fame. LeBron James and KD, you could probably say that about them. I think they're the only current MVPs. I mean, Tim Duncan would be another one. You know, those guys, he's going to be in the Hall of Fame. KG, Dirk, like, those guys are all in already, even if they retire. So basically the question is, will Derrick Rose make the Hall of Fame? I think it's nearly, you know, there's like a 5% chance, probably even less than that, like a 2% chance.
Yeah,
that he ever
will. The ship is probably largely sailed on that. I mean, he had just is it right that last night he had, last night from when we're recording this, not to give it away, he had his first dunk of the season, which.
Yeah, it wasn't that good either. But, you know, he's 27. It's not, that's natural. I think actually, this is the scenario in which he could make it to me. All right, he's actually played, you know, he's averaging like 20 a game on pretty efficient scoring since, you know, like February 1st or whatever it is. Let's say he could just do that for 2 or 3 more years and play at this same level. I mean, not impossible if you play some away for 2 months. Probably unlikely that he keeps shooting like this, especially from mid-range, but not impossible that he could keep this up for 2 or 3 more years and the Bulls actually get good again and get it, you know, the team into the conference finals, maybe even make a finals during that period. That's the only way that I could see it. Like, oh, he's such a great comeback story, and remember how unbelievably awesome he was at the beginning, and maybe he gets just enough of a boost from that, you know, sort of Bernard King style. You know, that, but even Bernard had probably more good years than Derek did at the beginning. Maybe that's the way that it happens, but I would consider it a very unlikely possibility at this point.
Doing some historical revisionism, if Mario Chalmers doesn't hit that game-tying shot in the NCAA title game, I think that his chances would be much higher.
Because it's the Sorry Basketball Hall of Fame instead of the NBA.
And I just think this guy came in as an NCAA champion and won the MVP, and then his career was derailed, and then he came back. And then that's a narrative that I think that people latch on to. And I think it would have to be more than like 2 years. I think if he put up like 4 years of like a 20-7 line with reasonable efficiency, then maybe people start to talk themselves into it. But I don't think that's...
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest part is just the team getting to be good again, right? I mean, like, that's, if he could get back into the spotlight and kind of be viewed again as the leader. And a lot of it too is that there's been, I think mostly wrongly, this controversy about him missing this time and that, you know, this implication that he's a wuss, which I don't agree with, obviously. But, you know, it hasn't just been, all right, he's just tore his ACL. He tore his ACL again, and just there was no way for him to come back. He was just out for the year for 2 years of these like inevitable fits and starts to where there is now such fatigue that I think there is actually like, you know, it's become underrated now, actually, how well he's played these last, and also the team has sucked too, but how well he's played this last month and a half or so.
Yeah, that's fair, but it's at the same time, it's you know, his play being underrated is still, it's his play being underrated, not him playing at anything resembling a you know, not even Hall of Fame, let alone All-Star level, is, you know, he's been a good player for the last little bit, which is, you know, it's nice, it's good, it's important, because there were times when it looked like that wasn't even, you know, on the table, but it's still the gap between there and where he would need to be.
Colin Miller, this would be a good one for you, Seth. I hear often you can control the number of three-point attempts, but not three-point percentage. Then, is it merely coincidence that San Antonio, Boston, Indiana, and Golden State all rank in the top 5 in both opponent three-point percentage and adjusted defensive rating?
This is a really good question. I think that you know, as someone who talks a lot about, you know, that defensive three-point percentage being mostly luck, I think that's probably overstating it slightly. I think you can control three-point percentage in terms of the kinds, not control, but influence in terms of the kinds of threes you're giving up. And then the big break there is, you know, catch and shoot threes versus forcing off the dribble threes, which tend to be, you know, late shot clock, more contested, so on and so forth.
Yeah, or corner versus non-corner, if only because corner threes are more likely to be open, as your research has shown.
Yeah, and I think these are, without pulling it up right away, I know Golden State and San Antonio are certainly among the two best teams, and I wouldn't be surprised at all to see Boston and Indiana are also, in terms of allowing the fewest on a per possession basis, allowing the fewest catch and shoot threes. So the bigger proportion of their threes are coming in these kind of harder pull up late clock off the dribble situation. So, you know, if you think about it, a catch and shoot three means someone's catching the ball open enough to think that they can get a good shot off. So if these teams aren't allowing those kind of catches, it's kind of natural that they're not allowing quite as many quality threes. So I think that,
let me ask you this. Sorry to put you on the spot here, but is there a correlation between giving up less 3-point attempts and giving up a lower 3-point
percentage? There is a slight correlation in that, but I think it's because the more threes you're giving up, the greater proportion of them are the kind of the open catch and shoot. This because there's kind of a baseline level of kind of pull up threes that unless you're playing Golden State and Portland every game, teams aren't going to really be taking a lot more of those. So if you're adding more 3-pointers against, they're going to be kind of the defensive breakdown, guy catches the ball when open and rises and fires kind of shot.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense to me that, you know, there are a baseline 15 3-point attempts that every team has to take per game just because the shot clock's running down, you got to jack one up or, you know, whatever. And then that one, whatever you add, and so this is true, I'm just theorizing that you're going to shoot the same percentage on sort of those baseline 15 3-pointers around the league, but then as you begin to add more, that's when the juicier ones become more of
And it's still going to be incredibly noisy on a single season basis for any team, kind of the percentage they allow, but you can, like I said, you can influence it. And there's probably a slight degree of coincidence that these teams are all kind of bunched together. It's not a coincidence that, you know, the defensive rating and 3-point percentage is highly correlated, because that's just a given. If the other team doesn't make shots, they have your defensive rating is better. Now, whether or not that's the degree to which that's good defense versus the other team just missing is a more open question. But not allowing catch and shoot threes is a very good way to not allow, you know, a high opponent offensive ratings.
All right, what do we have next?
We talked about a little bit last time, but so let's bring it up again. Assuming Harrison Barnes, this is from Christopher Hartig. What teams would be logical fits for Harrison Barnes aside from Golden State? He says, I was thinking Minnesota. As someone who likes the Timberwolves, I say no thank you. What do you say?
Did you yourself are saying no thank
for
you?
For putting my sort of soft Timberwolves hat on, I say no thank you.
He'd be a lot better than any four-man that they have on the roster right now. He would actually, like, provide some three-point shooting and some switchability and some defense. I think he would be a totally fine fit there. And I think the thing about him is that there are a million places where he would fit in just fine. Like, he's not going to be a superstar, but you can play him in a bunch of different roles. And he, even if he's going to be overpaid a little bit on his contract, he's not going to be overpaid and, like, give you nothing. You know, he still provides some spacing, still provides you, like, a little bit of mismatch scoring and some athleticism. His defense is, you know, can be average across a number of positions. And because I think, like, so many teams can use him, it's that's why there could be a bidding war for his services more than because, you know, he just has such a high ceiling. It's just that there's not enough money to go around, and a lot of teams could use him. I mean, if you just go through the list of teams, the number of teams who could use him, you know, he would be useful on the Celtics, the Nets, going through teams with cap states, like the Nuggets, the Mavs, probably not the Pistons, probably not the Hornets, the Bulls even, he might be. They already have kind of two combo forwards already that they have Stanley Johnson that they're grooming, so, you know, maybe not him. The Pacers, he would be, the Rockets, he would be excellent on as a four-man for them. The Clippers, he would be a good 3/4-man for them playing. I mean, there are 20 teams in the league that could totally make use of him as a combo forward kind of guy. And so that level of versatility, even if it's not at the absolute highest level, is something that I think is very useful.
Yeah, no, I think I was being too flippant. I mean, the part of the no thank you is the assumption that it's going to come at a price tag of, you know, 4 years, $80 million.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we're assuming, I mean, yeah, his max contract would probably be 4 years, $90 million. I think it's possible that he gets that. Also, you know, we have to see how he finishes the year out too. I think he clearly has been affected by this high ankle sprain still. But I think there are just, yeah, so many teams that can use him. And you talk about the opportunity cost. Yeah, you know, he wouldn't be my number one target in free agency if I had my total pick of the litter, but those pick of the litter guys are going to be done, and there's still going to be, you know, 10 teams that have max space out there.
I think that, you know, almost sight unseen, I think I'd rather have Kent Bazemore on the contract he's going to get than Harrison Barnes on the contract he's going to get.
Yeah, I think I would disagree with that because I don't necessarily believe in, and I think Bazemore is going to get maybe like $12 million or something, you know, $9 to $12 million. But I disagree with that because I think Barnes can guard 2 through 4. Bazemore can kind of guard 1 and 2, maybe 3 if it's not that good of a guy. I don't believe Bazemore doesn't have the track record of shooting threes that Barnes does. And that ability to just play as a small ball for Barnes, that's the thing that really unlocks it for me to just I think I would probably still prefer Barnes than Bazemore, but I understand.
Yeah. I mean, he just screams winner's curse to me in terms of, you know.
But he's also really young too. That's the other thing that you're paying for is that he may not. You know, I think. All right, let's say he just plays exactly the way he's played. You know, we'll say he's been injured this year. Let's say he plays exactly the way he played last year throughout the duration of his contract. You're probably overpaying for him by like $5 million, $7 million a season. That's not that bad, considering you're going to be overpaying for just about anyone. And then there's some possibility that he actually grows into like really being worth the contract. So I think that there are a lot worse contracts that are going to be handed out this summer than a potential max deal to Harrison Barnes.
That's probably true. That's not exactly a ringing endorsement, but probably true.
Just because he's young, he could actually improve, whereas some guys, you are just damn sure that they're never going to live up to that contract. Yeah. You know, I mean, and I would probably rather have Harrison Barnes on his contract than, I mean, when we're talking about over the life of the full 4 or 5 years, than I would Al Horford on what he's going to sign for, actually, if he signs for a 5-year max. Maybe a 4-year max, but maybe not, but yeah.
I think that.
All right, that's probably too long on that. Maybe we should move on.
Just the Al Horford, just the kind of the championship level equity that those first couple years would give you, maybe tips.
Right.
You know, neither here nor there. All right.
All right, let's see here. I'll do one. This is another good one for you, I think. This is from Thomas Prieto. Let's assume I am making a 100 greatest NBA players list. What advanced stats are most useful in making comparisons between players that played in different eras?
I think the place to start is kind of look at their the usage rate is always important, just in terms of that's a good way of controlling for pace in a quick and dirty way. It's almost impossible to not start with offensive stats just because.
The pace adjustment to me is number one, right? You know, this whole like Oscar's averaging a triple double, Wilt average 50 points a game, you know, pace adjustment and even minutes adjustment too, you know, because the big stars would play like 45 minutes a game back then. That's number one.
I mean, but also, I mean, we're going to be looking at primarily offensive stats just because still individual defensive stats are kind of crap still, at least in public domain. So you look at that, you look at efficiency relative to the league. You know, it's easy to get caught up in the hardest point of comparison kind of cross-generationally is how the adoption of the three-pointer has kind of changed what it is, especially in a wing player, you're looking for. So that's why it's kind of important to look at the efficiency relative to the league and the three-point rate relative to the league. I mean, it gets talked about a lot. You know, I forget the exact number, but like Larry Bird's highest three-point attempt season would have ranked in like the, you know, would have been about the 90th most threes taken last year or something like that. At the same time, like for his era, he was obviously one of the premier bombers. And you put him in today's NBA knowing that that's a shot you're looking for. And how many, you know, does he take a Ryan Anderson-like number of threes or something like that? I think that's certainly in play. But that those kind of the stylistic changes in the game are the hardest things to really adjust for. And that's why you do have to compare relative to kind of what the sort of average player at that position or role was doing at the time. So it's kind of a dodge of the question a little bit because I don't love the cross-generational statistical comparisons anyway, but those would be sort of the things I would be looking at.
Yeah, I think that just looking at someone's performance, because the number one question that you have to ask before you can even compare across eras is you got to figure out how good that guy was at the time. Yeah. That's number one, right? And so if you're going to say that Wilt Chamberlain, oh, yeah, he only shot 50% in 1962, that's not really that good for, you know, look at, like, today's awesome big guys, they shoot 60%. Oh, wait a minute, like, Wilt was, like, number two in the whole league in field goal percentage that year. You know, like, so looking at it compared to the era, I want to know, all right, you better prove to me, first off, that this guy was, like, one of the best guys during his era. And then you can start to compare kind of generationally. The other thing that I think you really have to look at, too, for the older guys, and we didn't have the on-off metrics, is just how good was his team doing on both ends? Like, I talked about this in the NBA Rank podcast. For example, all right, we don't have individual defensive metrics, but everyone said at the time Bill Russell was an awesome defensive player. And guess what? The Celtics were number one in defense every single year, basically, that he was on the team. So you can say, all right, at the team level, we have anecdotal reports he was really important to their defense. And guess what? Their team overall did really well defensively. Same thing like Oscar Robertson. They were number one in offense, or number two basically every year that he played, without having a great supporting cast. So that's, I think, something that you can look at as well. Bob Lanier, I concluded, might be a little overrated because his teams were never really any good on defense, and he was the center. You're really important to the defense. So I think those type of things, and then I generally, from there, will kind of skew to favoring modern guys a little bit, but still, if someone was just so dominant in their era, you know, you have to give that a lot of consideration as well. You got anything else on that one?
To reiterate the point, basketball is much more difficult to make these cross era comparisons than a sport like baseball. The difference in the games is a big reason why. I mean, baseball is, without, you know, oversimplifying it, baseball as played today is pretty similar to the way it was 100 years ago. It's, you know, pitcher throws ball, see ball, hit ball. You know, minor adjustments here or there. What is a good shot in basketball? That's something that's a definition for, as a player, making the choice of when to shoot or not. You're the internal calculus of what is a good shot that I should be taking has changed so much, so many times over the years, that even, you know, that basic, like you were saying, the shooting percentage thing, even that comparison across years, are you penalizing a guy for playing in an era when you hit that shot half the time, do that every time, was good advice versus, you know, kind of the quote lost art of the mid range. Well, part of it is that we have a better understanding now that, you know, a pull up 17 footer is not as good a shot as some other one. So guys are shooting less of those now, but that's because they've kind of been instructed and coached not to, and expecting players to kind of internalize these analytical discoveries before they've even been made is, I think, a little bit unfair. So that's, you know, what you have to judge them almost against what they're trying to accomplish, as much as kind of the blank statistical record of what they did accomplish, if that makes sense.
Totally, totally. All right, we got time for two more here. This is from Big Match PBA, clearly his real name. Is Steph Curry winning the MVP a foregone conclusion already? The answer to that is yes, but he makes the point that he thinks Kawhi Leonard should still have a shot, and you know, ESPN's RPM metric, which is not a definitive ranking, but can be an indication of how good players might be. Steph's chuckling in the background at that, because that's the point he makes a lot. But basically what he's saying is Steph is the number one offensive player. Kawhi is probably the number one defensive player. Whereas Steph, you know, Kawhi might be a top 15 offensive player. Steph is certainly not in the top 40 on defense. So basically the question is, like, what is more important, offense or defense? And if they are the same, why aren't defensive guys kind of getting more credit? So my question to you is, you know, are offense and defense equally important in determining whether teams win basketball games on an individual level? You know, I mean, like, or would you rather have the number one offensive player in the league or the number one defensive player in the league, I guess, is kind of the roundabout way
Number one offensive player, no question about it. On an individual level, you can do various estimates. It's probably offense maybe twice as important. Again, on an individual effect on winning, that's a number of different things you can look at where, I think that the average spread between offenses is, or not the average, but the general spread between team offensive performance is usually about twice as big as defensive. Pace of a game is determined twice as much by the offense as the defense. Just a number of things, that kind of two-thirds ratio seems to hold true. And the big reason is kind of, we get back to the usage rate. You can choose to ride an offensive player for much more of the game than you can employ a guy defensively.
You can just throw it to someone that guy's not guarding, and I think, if you look at, I think I've made this comparison before, but the difference to me in offense between Steph Curry and Omer Asik is far greater than the difference between Kawhi and like Doug McDermott on defense to me.
I think that's right, because you can on defense you can find a way to hide a guy who's not great. It's much harder to tuck a guy away on offense and not have it affect the team on every single possession. It's the kind of thing we see with Oklahoma City on a game to game basis where, it's just more difficult for them if they have Andre Roberson standing in the corner because the other team doesn't have to guard him. And that's every single possession.
Yeah. Here's maybe another way to think about it, right? Like, what would hurt your team more? Having Omer Asik shoot on every possession, or having Doug McDermott guard whoever was shooting on the other team every possession?
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty clear answer to me, that Asik would hurt you
because,
way more.
Asik is never going to make a shot, even if McDermott's the worst defender in the history of the world ever. Guys are just going to miss a fair amount of the time because that's how it works.
Yeah, and you can help that guy defensively too. Like, you can't help somebody make a shot.
Right. I mean, you can, but he's got to catch the ball first, and that's why. and again, Omer Asik. So there we go.
Totally. All right, let's move on here to one more.
Oh, can I actually? I've got one.
Let's do it.
Parody Ronald. I hope. Apologize.
Hold on. That can't be right. All right. Yeah, I'm gonna go with Parody Ronell. That's my guess. But Parody, let us know which one of us still got it wrong, but at least was closer.
In the recent Spurs-Golden State-Warriors game, you think Curry was defended too roughly against the rules, especially early in the game, to get him out of his rhythm. Is that a strategy to use against him by other teams? Should they get away with it? So what do you think about that?
I don't know if he was defended too roughly. I think that mostly he just, those two games, both that game and against Minnesota, he just did not necessarily have his normal juice from a leg standpoint and just didn't look as quick to me. I think that was really the root of his struggles. He looked like he had it back against the Clippers. So I don't really ascribe it to, I mean, obviously San Antonio is an awesome defense. They did a great job. I don't really ascribe his struggles to him being roughly defended. And I think overall the impact of such tactics are vastly overrated.
I think that, to some extent, the amount you're allowed to, especially off the ball, I think the amount you're allowed to.
Yeah, if you can just hold dudes, yeah, maybe
think,
that's
You say, oh, every game should be officiated the same way. I mean, that's nice in theory, but there's going to be, a range of contact that is going to be acceptable that varies game to game. And to be honest, as long as they're consistent within a game, I'm largely fine with that. Now, obviously, a game called One Way is going to be more beneficial to certain skill sets than another. So if a team is allowed to, bump him a little more, maybe get away with a hold here or there, that is going to make it easier to guard him. That's unquestionable. And I think that, restricting his movement is something you kind of have to try to do to slow him down some. And I think also part of that, but getting specifically to the Spurs-Warriors game, a large part of that was, this is a point I've made quite frequently, is that San Antonio's offense put them in position to be able to find him. In the first game, when they were throwing the ball over the gym, taking quick shots, You know, Curry was able to get some open looks just because the game was discombobulated, and just finding him to even get in contact with him was a struggle for San Antonio. In the most recent game, you know, even if they weren't super efficient on offense, though, I mean, they scored over a point per possession, so they were okay. Their offensive possessions were ending in such a way that whoever was assigned to Curry was like, there he is right away and able to, you know, just be in his space. And I think that was very important for San Antonio. You know, a lot of it was him just missing, but they were also there to influence that to the degree they could. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, be as physical with him as you can get away with.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. All right, we have one last question, surpassing importance here. This is from Lanny DeRue. Is there anything better than a banked-in game winner?
Depends. Is it a three-pointer? You can bank in a game winner.
Well, I think it would have to.
You can bank in a game winner. If it's a three-pointer, it's BS. And you won't convince me otherwise, because you've missed the shot so badly that it banks in unintentionally, and you shouldn't celebrate about that. That's like, you know, in soccer, when there's an unwritten rule that if you play for one team, then you go to another team and you score against your old team, you don't celebrate. You shouldn't celebrate a banked in three-point game winner. That's my thought.
Well, let's say you walked out the door and someone, you know, the hand of God just dumped like $200,000 out of a trash can, like right onto your head. Would you celebrate that? You would, right? You'd just be happy that it happened, right? I mean, now if you start like pointing to your chest and like, oh, hell yeah, like I'm the greatest because I banked in the three. That's one thing. If you could just be happy that it happened, like there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. No, okay, a shrug and yay is okay. That's what I do kind of thing is, ugh.
Yeah, like was Derrick Rose's celebration after he made the one last year, did that arouse your ire in game three against
the
Cavs
last year? I think
that was
the one that got me the article that Danny is referring, oh, sorry, Lanny is referring to. Is this general manager Danny LaRue as opposed to coach Lanny DeRue?
Oh man, yeah. Well, we had a question from Date Nunkin last week, so I thought it was only fair that Lanny DeRue could get his day. I'm not as against it. I mean, I'm, you know what, 2 years younger than you, so clearly I'm just not as reactionary and curmudgeonly as you are. But yeah, I mean, I think if you're just like, you know, you go out afterwards and in the interview you say like, oh yeah, like this, that's what I do. I'm a late game player, like blah, blah. But like, you just won a playoff game. Like you're so happy. You're allowed to just be happy that you won, you know, as long as you're not trying to, now if you're going to lie and say like, oh yeah, I was trying to do that, then yeah, I agree with you, but I think it's okay to just be like, all right, so happy that fortune like decided to favor me.
Although at the same time, maybe it's the Boston homer in me, but was it Paul Pierce who, you know, did you call bank? I call a game. All right. That's just going so far that it becomes okay again, but that's just so ridiculous.
Well, and what if it's like a shot that is just like, you know, so far outside of the normal range, like some of these like Steph, like banked in half court shots lately, like is he allowed to celebrate on those? Because in that case, the standard is almost like, all right, I'm just getting it close. Like you deserve credit for even getting it close enough to where it could even bank in. You know, like even getting it that close is kind of like value added over what the normal player could. So I think you're good celebrating any shot that occurs outside of like, you know, 40 feet or like that Moutier game winner that he had the other day. I can't remember that banked in or not. I don't think
like
it did actually.
Clutch,
but that was just
kind of horizontal to the ground.
Oh
yeah,
yeah.
You know,
because then you're a badass for even getting it close in my mind.
You know, I think I've said my piece on this, and I've burnished my old man yells at cloud credentials for just enough on this topic. So banked in threes are BS, and you should feel bad if you do it anyway.
All right, that's a great one to end on. Seth, where can we follow you on Twitter? Where can we find your
follow
work?
Me on Twitter at Seth Partnow. Follow me and the rest of the writers at Nylon Calculus. You can also find my writing at the Washington Post Fancy Stats blog and on Vice Sports.
Awesome. All right, thanks so much for coming on for this two-part Sans Lonnie,
Lonnie DeRue.
Thank you. I can't even say it anymore. All right, yeah, that's all right. This is like 4 hours of podcasting for me today, so it's probably time to call it quits. And we'll talk to you next time, but hopefully you will check out our sponsor, Indochino. In the meantime, use that CapSpace code and support the program. We'll talk to you all next time.